The Everlasting Man by G.K. Chesterton. Book 1, Chapter 6, The Demons and the Philosophers. I have dwelt at some little length on this imaginative sort of paganism, which has crowded the world with temples and is everywhere the parent of popular festivity. For the central history of civilization, as I see it, consists of two further stages before the final stage of Christendom. The first was the struggle between this paganism and something less worthy than itself, and the second the process by which it grew in itself less worthy. In this very varied and often very vague polytheism, there was a weakness of original sin. Pagan gods were depicted as tossing men like dice, and indeed they are loaded dice. About sex especially, men are born unbalanced. We might almost say men are born mad. They scarcely reach sanity till they reach sanctity. This disproportion dragged down the winged fancies, and filled the end of paganism with a mere filth and litter of spawning gods. But the first point to realize is that this sort of paganism had an early collision with another sort of paganism, and that the issue of that essentially spiritual struggle really determined the history of the world. In order to understand it, we must pass to a review of the other kind of paganism. It can be considered much more briefly. Indeed, there is a very real sense in which the less that is said about it, the better. If we have called the first sort of mythology the daydream, we might very well call the second sort of mythology the nightmare. Superstition recurs in all ages, and especially in rationalistic ages. I remember defending the religious tradition against a whole luncheon table of distinguished agnostics, and before the end of our conversation, every one of them had procured from his pocket, or exhibited on his watch chain, some charm or talisman from which he admitted that he was never separated. I was the only person present who had neglected to provide himself with a fetish. Superstition recurs in a rationalist age because it rests on something which, if not identical with rationalism, is not unconnected with skepticism. It is at least very closely connected with agnosticism. It rests on something that is really a very human and intelligible sentiment, like the local invocations of the new men in popular paganism. But it is an agnostic sentiment, for it rests on two feelings. First, that we do not really know the laws of the universe. And second, that they may be very different to all we call reason. Such men realize the real truth that enormous things do often turn upon tiny things. When a whisper comes, from tradition or what not, that one particular tiny thing is the key or clue, something deep and not altogether senseless in human nature, tells them that it is not unlikely. This feeling exists in both the forms of paganism here under consideration. But when we come to the second form of it, we find it transformed and filled with another and more terrible spirit. In dealing with the lighter thing called mythology, I have said little about the most disputable aspect of it. The extent to which such invocation of the spirits of the sea or the elements can indeed call spirits from the vasty deep, or rather, as the Shakespearean scoffer put it, whether the spirits come when they are called. I believe that I am right in thinking that this problem, practical as it sounds, did not play a dominant part in the poetical business of mythology. But I think it even more obvious, on the evidence, that things of that sort have sometimes appeared, even if they were only appearances. But when we come to the world of superstition, in a more subtle sense, there is a shade of difference, a deepening and a darkening shade. Doubtless, most popular superstition is as frivolous as most popular mythology. Men do not believe as a dogma that God would throw a thunderbolt at them for walking under a ladder. More often, they amuse themselves with the not very laborious exercise of walking round it. There is no more in it than what I have already adumbrated, a sort of airy agnosticism about the possibilities of so strange a world. But there is another sort of superstition that does definitely look for results, what might be called a realistic superstition. And with that, the question of whether spirits do answer or do appear becomes much more serious. As I have said, it seems to me pretty certain that they sometimes do. But about that, there is a distinction that has been the beginning of much evil in the world. Whether it be because the fall has really brought men nearer to less desirable neighbors in the spiritual world, or whether it is merely that the mood of men, eager or greedy, finds it easier to imagine evil, I believe that the black magic of witchcraft has been much more practical and much less poetical than the white magic of mythology. I fancy the garden of the witch has been kept much more carefully than the woodland of the nymph. I fancy the evil field has ever been more fruitful than the good. To start with, some impulse, perhaps a sort of desperate impulse, drove men to the darker powers when dealing with practical problems. There was a sort of secret and perverse feeling that the darker powers would really do things, that they had no nonsense about them. And indeed, that popular phrase exactly expresses the point. The gods of mere mythology had a great deal of nonsense about them. They had a great deal of good nonsense about them, in the happy and hilarious sense in which we talk of the nonsense of Jabberwocky or the land where Jumblies live. But the man consulting a demon felt as many a man has felt in consulting a detective, especially a private detective, that it was dirty work, but that the work would really be done. A man did not exactly go into the wood to meet a nymph. He rather went with the hope of meeting a nymph. It was an adventure rather than an assignation. But the devil really kept his appointments, and even in one sense kept his promises, even if a man sometimes wished afterwards, like Macbeth, that he had broken them. In the accounts given us of many rude and savage races, we gather that the cult of demons often came after the cult of deities, and even after the cult of one single and supreme deity. It may be suspected that in almost all such places the higher deity is felt to be too far off for appeal in certain petty matters, and men invoke the spirits because they are, in a more literal sense, familiar spirits. But with the idea of employing the demons who get things done, a new idea appears, more worthy of the demons. It may indeed be truly described as the idea of being worthy of the demons, of making oneself fit for their fastidious and exacting society. Superstition of the lighter sort toys with the idea that some trifle, some small gesture, such as throwing the salt, may touch the hidden spring that works the mysterious machinery of the world. And there is, after all, something in the idea of such an open sesame. But with the appeal to lower spirits comes the horrible notion that the gesture must not only be very small, but very low, that it must be a monkey trick of an utterly ugly and unworthy sort. Sooner or later, a man deliberately sets himself to do the most disgusting thing he can think of. It is felt that the extreme of evil will extort a sort of attention or answer from the evil powers under the surface of the world. This is the meaning of most of the cannibalism in the world. For most cannibalism is not a primitive or even a bestial habit. It is artificial and even artistic, a sort of art for art's sake. Men do not do it because they do not think it horrible, but on the contrary, because they do think it horrible. They wish, in the most literal sense, to sup on horrors. That is why it is often found that rude races like the Australian natives are not cannibals, while much more refined and intelligent races, like the New Zealand Maoris, occasionally are. They are refined and intelligent enough to indulge sometimes in a self-conscious diabolism. But if we could understand their minds, or even really understand their language, we should probably find that they were not acting as ignorant, that is, as innocent, cannibals. They are not doing it because they do not think it wrong, but precisely because they do think it wrong. They are acting like a Parisian decadent at a black mass. But the black mass has to hide underground from the presence of the real mass. In other words, the demons have really been in hiding since the coming of Christ on earth. The cannibalism of the higher barbarians is in hiding from the civilization of the white man. But before Christendom, and especially outside Europe, this was not always so. In the ancient world, the demons often wandered abroad like dragons. They could be positively and publicly enthroned as gods. Their enormous images could be set up in public temples in the center of populous cities. And all over the world, the traces can be found of this striking and solid fact, so curiously overlooked by the moderns who speak of all such evil as primitive and early in evolution, that as a matter of fact, some of the very highest civilizations of the world were the very places where the horns of Satan were exalted, not only to the stars, but in the face of the sun. Take, for example, the Aztecs and American Indians of the ancient empires of Mexico and Peru. They were at least as elaborate as Egypt or China, and only less lively than that central civilization which is our own. But those who criticize that central civilization, which is always their own civilization, have a curious habit of not merely doing their legitimate duty in condemning its crimes, but of going out of their way to idolize its victims. They always assume that before the advent of Europe, there was nothing anywhere but Eden. And Swinburne, in that spirited chorus of the nations in Songs Before Sunrise, used an expression about Spain in her South American conquests, which always struck me as very strange. He said something about her sins and sons through sinless lands dispersed, and how they made accursed the name of man, and thrice accursed the name of God. It may be reasonable enough that he should say the Spaniards were sinful, but why in the world should he say that the South Americans were sinless? Why should he have supposed that continent to be exclusively populated by archangels or saints perfect in heaven? It would be a strong thing to say of the most respectable neighborhood. But when we come to think of what we really do know of that society, the remark is rather funny. We know that the sinless priests of this sinless people worshipped sinless gods, who accepted as the nectar and ambrosia of their sunny paradise nothing but incessant human sacrifice, accompanied by horrible torments. We may note also, in the mythology of this American civilization, that element of reversal or violence against instinct, of which Dante wrote, which runs backwards everywhere through the unnatural religion of the demons. It is notable not only in ethics, but in aesthetics. A South American idol was made as ugly as possible, as a Greek image was made as beautiful as possible. They were seeking the secret of power by working backwards against their own nature and the nature of things. There was always a sort of yearning to carve at last, in gold or granite or the dark red timber of the forests, a face at which the sky itself would break, like a cracked mirror. In any case, it is clear enough that the painted and gilded civilization of tropical America systematically indulged in human sacrifice. It is by no means clear, so far as I know, that the Eskimos ever indulged in human sacrifice. They were not civilized enough. They were too closely imprisoned by the white winter and the endless dark. Chill penury repressed their noble rage and froze the genial current of the soul. It was in brighter days and broader daylight that the noble rage is found unmistakably raging. It was in richer and more instructed lands that the genial current flowed on the altars, to be drunk by great gods wearing goggling and grinning masks, and called on in terror or torment by long cacophonous names that sound like laughter in hell. A warmer climate and a more scientific cultivation were needed to bring forth these blooms, to draw up towards the sun the large leaves and flamboyant blossoms that gave their gold and crimson and purple to that garden, which Swinburne compares to the Hesperides. There was at least no doubt about the dragon. I do not raise in this connection the special controversy about Spain and Mexico, but I may remark in passing that it resembles exactly the question that must in some sense be raised afterwards about Rome and Carthage. In both cases there has been a queer habit among the English of always siding against the Europeans, and representing the rival civilization, in Swinburne's phrase, as sinless, when its sins were obviously crying, or rather screaming, to heaven. For Carthage also was a high civilization, indeed a much more highly civilized civilization. And Carthage also founded that civilization on a religion of fear, sending up everywhere the smoke of human sacrifice. Now, it is very right to rebuke our own race or religion for falling short of our own standards and ideals. But it is absurd to pretend that they fell lower than the other races and religions that professed the very opposite standards and ideals. There is a very real sense in which the Christian is worse than the heathen, the Spaniard worse than the Red Indian, or even the Roman potentially worse than the Carthaginian. But there is only one sense in which he is worse, and that is not in being positively worse. The Christian is only worse because it is his business to be better. This inverted imagination produces things of which it is better not to speak. Some of them, indeed, might almost be named without being known, for they are of that extreme evil which seems innocent to the innocent. They are too inhuman even to be indecent. But without dwelling much longer in these dark corners, it may be noted as not irrelevant here that a certain anti-human antagonism seems to recur in this tradition of black magic. There may be suspected, as running through it everywhere, for instance, a mystical hatred of the idea of childhood. people would understand better the popular fury against the witches if they remembered that the malice most commonly attributed to them was preventing the birth of children. The Hebrew prophets were perpetually protesting against the Hebrew race relapsing into an idolatry that involves such a war upon children. And it is probable enough that this abominable apostasy from the God of Israel has occasionally appeared in Israel since, in the form of what is called ritual murder, not, of course, by any representative of the religion of Judaism, but by individual and irresponsible diabolists who did happen to be Jews. This sense that the forces of evil especially threaten childhood is found again in the enormous popularity of the child martyr of the Middle Ages. Chaucer did but give another version of a very national English legend when he conceived the wickedest of all possible witches as the dark alien woman watching behind her high lattice and hearing, like the babble of a brook down the stony street, the singing of little Saint Hugh. Anyhow, the part of such speculations that concerns this story centered especially round that eastern end of the Mediterranean where the nomads had turned gradually into traders and had begun to trade with the whole world. Indeed, in the sense of trade and travel and colonial extension, it already had something like an empire of the whole world. Its purple dye, the emblem of its rich pomp and luxury, had steeped the wares which were sold far away amid the last crags of Cornwall and the sails that entered the silence of tropic seas amid all the mystery of Africa. It might be said truly to have painted the map purple. It was already a worldwide success when the princes of Tyre would hardly have troubled to notice that one of their princesses had condescended to marry the chief of some tribe called Judah, when the merchants of its African outpost would only have curled their bearded and Semitic lips with a slight smile at the mention of a village called Rome. And indeed, no two things could have seemed more distant from each other, not only in space but in spirit, than the monotheism of the Palestinian tribe and the very virtues of the small Italian republic. There was but one thing between them, and the thing which divided them has united them. Very various and incompatible were the things that could be loved by the consuls of Rome and the prophets of Israel, but they were at one in what they hated. It is very easy in both cases to represent that hatred as something merely hateful. It is easy enough to make a merely harsh and inhuman figure, either of Elijah raving above the slaughter of Carmel, or Cato thundering against the amnesty of Africa. These men had their limitations and their local passions, but this criticism of them is unimaginative, and therefore unreal. It leaves out something immense and intermediate, facing east and west, and calling up this passion in its eastern and western enemies. And that something is the first subject of this chapter. The civilization that centered in Tyre and Sidon was above all things practical. It has left little in the way of art and nothing in the way of poetry. But it prided itself upon being very efficient, and it followed in its philosophy and religion that strange and sometimes secret train of thought which we have already noted in those who look for immediate effects. There is always in such a mentality an idea that there is a shortcut to the secret of all success, something that would shock the world by this sort of shameless thoroughness. They believed, in the appropriate modern phrase, in people who delivered the goods. In their dealings with their god Moloch, they themselves were always careful to deliver the goods. It was an interesting transaction, upon which we shall have to touch more than once in the rest of the narrative. It is enough to say here that it involved the theory I have suggested about a certain attitude towards children. This was what called up against it in simultaneous fury the servant of one god in Palestine and the guardians of all the household gods in Rome. This is what challenged two things naturally so much divided by every sort of distance and disunion, whose union was to save the world. End of part 1 of chapter 6.